Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
The way you said potholes made it sound like you were in favor of potholes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Leave the potholes alone. Yeah.
To fix potholes?
Why the hell would you want to fix them?
Make potholes great again.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by managing editor Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis. Am I just managing editor?
Yeah.
No more daily news?
Yeah.
Wow.
Congrats.
Take that, Andy. Just kidding. Miss you, man.
Did you miss his, like... incessant shifting and jitters?
No, I don't.
Okay. I do a little bit, but
well, you know, tie-dye shirts can be itchy.
Yes. It's true.
I don't know if that's true, but
and those are the dulcet tones of our own education reporter Jacob McQuinney. What's up, Jacob?
Nothing much, Scott Lewis. How you doing?
Coming up on the show this week, the city's first new safe camping site for homeless residents is open. This week, Mayor Todd Gloria and other city leaders announced the opening of the campsite at 20th and B. It's the first of two that are expected to open, along with a ban on camping in public land. We'll discuss the details of this whole effort by the mayor, plus a fact check that our Will Huntsbury pulled off about his claim about how many shelter spaces he's opened up. Finally, you may head into Home Depot soon and get asked to sign something to fix potholes. It's a ballot initiative that could be on the 2024 ballot with several other tax increases. I'll go through the behind-the-scenes maneuvering going on about that. That's all coming up. Stay with us. But first, there's a news story that caught our eye. This is in the Union Tribune. I'll read the lead. Two protesters offended by a pride exhibit at the Rancho Peñasquitos Library have checked out nearly all the books in the display and vowed to keep them until the library eliminates what they call, quote, inappropriate content for children.
The vow is what gets me, right?
The vow. From our cold, dead hands, you will not have these stories back. Now, Jacob, you were pointing out how this is a low energy protest.
It is, yeah. There's no like laying on the Supreme Court steps. No signs were made. It's just library card and you're good. And then take some books home, I guess.
It has the interesting impact that you and I talked about the Streisand effect. Mm-hmm. Will you explain that Streisand effect, please?
Yeah. So
he's
basically,
not taking credit for this one.
I appreciate the citation. So basically, the Streisand effect refers to when an individual's attempt to essentially hide something brings further attention to it. Right. The original example was, and I may be getting some of the details wrong here, but there were two photographers who did a project of photographing all of California's coast. One of those photographs happened to include Barbara Streisand's beachside home. And apparently Streisand employed a lawyer to say, hey, you guys got to take this picture down. Before the lawyer had gotten involved, the photo had been viewed maybe a handful of times. And after the lawyer got involved, all of a sudden the photo was all over the internet. Mm-hmm. So I think this does have a similar effect, right? I mean, right. Who really would have known outside of this small community of Rancho Peñasquitos that there was a pride exhibit at the library, and now they've drawn much more attention to not only the exhibit but all of the books therein.
And the exhibit itself was like pretty simple.
It was, yeah.
It's like a flag.
And, you know, no size. Shade to the librarian, but it was similarly low effort as this activism. Yeah.
It's a classic like little library or bookstore thing to do. Like, oh, yeah. It's Black History Month, and here's some things on that topic. Or, oh, the Titanic movie just came out. Here's all the stuff we have on the Titanic or whatever. And it's just like...
Well, mentioning Black History Month, Andrea, you pulled up some of the books. It was interesting that there is a book, What is Black Lives Matter, that it seems was in that display. Did they check that out as well? They're against LGBTQ theory and like Black Lives Matter.
What is Black Lives Matter? Yeah, that was included in there.
The description of that one is, it tells the history of political and social movement that advocates for nonviolent civil disobedience and protests against the incidents of police brutality and all racially motivated violence. And okay, well, better put that one in the garage.
They want to leave the like biography of Malcolm X there, but take home the like nonviolent protest one, right?
Yeah. Then there's the alternate impact here, where like they check out all these books, and now they're gonna the counter protest is gonna be to buy all the books again, and the library would have to buy the books again too. So the Streisand effect is in full optimization mode, where like now they're going to get more money to the publishers of the book. There is just a moral panic, and it's comical, but it's also dark.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't want to read those books, don't read them. And if you don't want your kids to read them, you can try to control what they collect. We all have certain control. But we all have to deal with the fact that we live in a free society, and about 12 or 13, they're going to start doing things that, you know, and maybe just talk to them about your beliefs and what you think. But the idea that this might have a Streisand effect in your house too, right?
Like, well, all of a sudden the books aren't in the library, but they're like sitting on your bedside table. I mean, what happens when little Joey walks in and sees... Rainbow Parade by Emily Nielsen. Or, like, oh, cool colors. Like,
yeah. Or The New Queer Conscience by Adam Ely. And they're like, boy, I hadn't thought about, you know, queer theory, but now I'm like.
All of a sudden you're sitting there at the breakfast table with your eggs, and your kid comes out with like a white t-shirt with Stonewall Was a Riot, like sharpied onto it, you know?
I think that, you know, maybe they're putting them in a safe or something. They seem like the type of people.
Yeah, so. They have to put them in a safe. Like,
funny to think
with
of
other combustibles like ammunition.
Sitting in a safe. I don't know. The idea of like them going into a library, it's like what I was talking about earlier. It's like coming in when you're going to a store and you're buying something really embarrassing, and you're like, it's not for me. It's for so-and-so, you know? Like, I would love to imagine like them, like, taking those books out.
So the logistics of it are, you can check out what you found up to
50 books at a time. Because, being such a nerd, I was like, wait, how can they even check out that many books at a time? You know, because library books have a limit on how long you can have a book checked out. So turns out you can check out 50 books at a time, and you can have them checked out for 30 days. And after 30 days, they automatically renew, and it'll renew for 5 more times in 30 days each time.
Now, the city notoriously got rid of fines for people, but there is a collections process still, so we may need to dig further about
There's two things, and I think there's like a funny troll here, because the automatic renewal process will do that 5 more times. However, if somebody has requested to read the book, then it won't renew, and that individual needs to return the book. And if they don't return the book, then it kicks off the process for, if a book is gone for more than 60 days, then it's considered a lost book. And then you do get sent to collections, and those fees can add up.
I just got to say, I think 50 books is way too many for somebody to be able to rent
at once. For 30 days. I mean, I guess they extend, but...
But 50 books?
That's dedication.
You could rent like the whole Goosebumps series like at the same time.
And if just you binge.
It'd have a long weekend of R.L. Stein.
Well, if you are a donor, a member of Voice San Diego, you'll get a note from me about some changes we went through a restructuring. I've been talking pretty openly over the last few months about us and how Voice San Diego was collecting a deficit and ending the fiscal year, and making a lot of pleas to all of you to support Voice San Diego. And many of you did, and thank you for that. We did come in a little bit short and needed to construct a budget for the new fiscal year that was tighter and had a lower burn rate. And out of that, we did have to lay off 2 employees, and we're not going to fill the role that Andy Keats had here. So that was a pretty big cut, and obviously had some impact and some discussion online that followed it. They've gotten a lot of outpouring of support, and I think just first off, they are great people who, if you have the opportunities to consider for different roles, you should. Absolutely. And these are always hard. Last time I went through this 12 years ago, it was brutal, and I never wanted to do it again. I swore I never would, but here we are again. Now, I wanted to discuss a little bit about the news world, though, because I think it's important to keep in mind sometimes. So we are a nonprofit. We get our money from donors. About 70-80% of our dollars right now come from individuals like you out there. We used to get a lot more from national sources, foundation grants and stuff. And that was because we were like the darling, right? We were like figuring things out in this nonprofit space. We weren't the first news nonprofit. Obviously, there were some public radio stations and others. The Center for Public Integrity had existed years before. We weren't the first online news organization. There were some before that, but we were the first to combine those 2 things, nonprofit and online, for a local area. And now there's like 300-400 of them across the country. And so the foundations that used to support us and others now have 400 little, you know, birds asking for the same resources. And so it's just a much different thing. And they always said, and we always pledged, to diversify our funding. And we have. We've had a lot of success with that. But there's a lot of individuals now who give whatever they can, from $35 to $100,000. We and I think a lot of news organizations saw a big jump in audience and in support during the pandemic and during the Trump years. And I think that we all kind of assumed a lot of that would stick and that the growth would continue from that point. And it didn't. We are not the only news organization going through something like this. KPBS, I saw, put out a big thing trying to close their own budget deficit by the end of the year. And of course, there's been a lot of national news about cutbacks and such. So there is just a correction going on, I think, around the news industry, and we're certainly not alone. I think one thing I'd just like to say is there are a lot of news organizations still trying to figure out what's going to happen. The advertising went from news organizations to groups like Facebook, Google, Instagram, Craigslist. All of those places took all of that advertising and frankly deliver it and deliver results and reporting better than a lot of news organizations did to those advertisers, right? And so every news organization basically is in the same boat we are, which is that they're trying to get money from people who value it. Now, there's 2 ways to do that, right? You get money from donations, or you get money from subscribers, people who pay to access the content. And the ones who are going for subscribers, they're doing well if they have massive audience, if they are like the New York Times with like hundreds of millions of potential eyeballs, and converting a substantial number of those to subscribers means significant revenue for them, and that can fund a newsroom largely out of that. Now, it hasn't proven to be quite as successful for at least like large metropolitan areas like the Dallas Morning News, the Union Tribune, and I think a lot of us are still wondering, like, will they be able to make that conversion happen? Because all of those news organizations are marching toward a cliff, and that is the moment where it is no longer profitable or make sense financially for them to print the newspapers, and yet they get so much of their money from that print product. And so when that cliff comes, will they have enough digital subscriptions or digital revenue to build a bridge to the future from that? And I think that's what we're all wondering. And so I think that there's the other side is like us, where it's we're asking for donations. And I think that as much trouble as we've had and are experiencing and going through, we do have a fundamentally sort of straightforward business model, which is we're going to try to do really good work, good shows like this, good impactful investigative journalism and newsletters that capture people's attention. And we want you to like that so much that you're willing to pay for it with whatever level you're comfortable with. Now, and we're probably going to have very few moments where we say you have to pay for it in order to access it. Mostly it's going to be, what is it worth to you? And so it's hard because I know that you're used to these like, hey, we need money things, and sometimes you don't give and things are okay. And sometimes you don't give and we have a horrible situation like this. I think what I'd like to communicate is like, we mean it when we need your support. And for those of you who did support, that means a lot. And, you know, we're going to work hard over the next few months and longer to show you that we still merit that, and that, you know, the people who helped build this place are still proud of it as well. So,
on a personal note, I'm still a young journalist. Jesse, when I was an intern here at Voice, was, you know, part editor and part therapist for me, and that was a really important experience. And I think a news organization is only as good as the caliber of the people that they attract and the people that they employ. I think luckily for Voice, we have had and continue to have some really, really, really amazing people.
Yeah. Well, the mayor promised that the first of two open and safe camping sites for homeless San Diegans would open by July 1st, and it looks like he has come through on that. The 136-tent campsite is now open, or will be open, at 20th and B Streets for people who either the police or others can direct people to these sites. They have tents set up, two people per tent, 136 tents. They have restrooms. They have meals set up. They have security set up. And it's being run by the Dreams for Change nonprofit. You actually encountered Dreams for Change recently, Andrea, at a safe camping or a safe parking spot. What do you know about Dreams for Change?
They operate several safe parking lots, which I guess it's in comparison, right? It's an open lot where you park your car. Depending on what contract they have and with who, they offer different things, but mainly it's sort of the same thing: access to restrooms, maybe one meal or two, access to showers, and the connection to case managers. Now the story I wrote about was specifically about a couple that was having a lot of issues just navigating the system as a whole. But in speaking to the nonprofit, I think that they're dealing with a lot of the same challenges as many others are. And that's when they're trying to make connections from, removing people from the situation that they're in and getting them into housing. So yeah. I'll be curious to see how much of, that sort of case manager or assistance there is at the lot, or if that's going to happen. But, you know, they manage these types of lots already.
Yeah, it seems like there will be a lot of relying on the existing case managers that these people have to come to this new safe camping site, as opposed to sending in new case managers from Dreams for Change, which is an interesting setup.
Mm-hmm. Well, this opening matters also. This week, the city council passed the final vote on the mayor's proposal to ban tent encampments and tent camping on public land if there's shelter available, and at all public land near schools, parks, and open space, waterways,
shelters,
transit,
these sort of sensitive areas at all times, whether there's shelter available or not. That has now passed all the steps it needs to at the city council. The mayor will sign it, and then he said he wouldn't start enforcing it until 30 days after this first lot was opened. Now it's open, so the clock starts, and so we'll have till the end of July when we start to see what the mayor and the police do now to enforce this ban going forward. So this is the first of two. They're supposed to open another much larger site at Lot O, which is also in the Balboa Park area. And Lot O is supposed to house several hundred tents. What is it, like more than 500 people are supposed to be able to go there. And it's going to be a big operation. We'll see how long it takes for them to get that together. But I think people looked at these sites and said, like, this has the most potential to lower the visible homeless situation in downtown. This is the easiest access for people who are living in tents right now. This has the most potential to change that dynamic. And it's what they kept pointing to when they said that we are going to ban and enforce this ban on city streets. So it's supposed to have a pretty big impact. Now, I think if it would have just opened itself, nobody would have reacted too much about it. But because it opened in concert with that ban, the mayor's office had to hit away a ton of backlash of people calling it a concentration camp or some sort of carceral response to the homeless crisis. And that's probably not ideal, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really interesting situation because I think for a lot of folks, more options were needed and they desired more options for people who were unsheltered. But its connection to the camping ban and the timing of it, and concerns that maybe they've rushed it or don't have the right supplies or tents or whatever it is, that they've really, really, really been significant. And I think the connection to the camping ban itself sort of poisoned the well of this whole effort to create camping sites.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the city's done this before, right? Did it during the hepatitis A outbreak.
This very same one, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and back then you said wasn't as...
it wasn't as controversial.
As controversial.
I still wonder what this ban will do, because I think a lot of people are saying, well, you're criminalizing the tent encampments that exist, and this is their option, which means this is something of a jail, even though you can leave and all that stuff. But it's still seen as like, you can't be here under the threat of criminal prosecution. Thus, you can only be here, which again seems to indicate it's a kind of jail. But I think that what's really interesting, though, is how police decide to use this ban, because I'm seeing more and more indication that it's not the prosecution that the mayor and the police are enthusiastic to do. What they're enthusiastic to do is have a tool to move people along. I think that this should better be characterized as the move people along ordinance, that they have been looking for and wanting something that they could use to say, you need to leave, you need to move along. Mm-hmm. And that every time we say, well, why don't you just prosecute the quality of life crimes that you're talking about at these encampments? They say, we can't do that until we see them do something wrong. We see them brandish a weapon. We see them punch somebody. We see them defecate or something. Then we can act. But if we don't see them, we can't do that. And this ordinance, all it takes for them to act is to see them camping, right? And that definition of camping itself is a little bit vague. So you can go and ask them to move along a lot easier. And if they refuse, like we've heard from some of the homeless residents that they might want to do, or that they might take it as a protest,
yeah,
then it might escalate up through the progression of enforcement all the way to a misdemeanor or even actual incarceration. Mm-hmm. But I think that the move along part is what they're looking forward to.
That's fascinating. I feel like, because a lot of people, I mean, in response to this ban, And I think even council member Monica Montgomery Stepp was asking, mm-hmm. what about, because in the city council meeting, the first time that they were discussing this ban, a lot of what was mentioned was, you know, crimes that were being committed by homeless people. And we've reported on some of that. And I think her questioning was, what about these crimes can you not prosecute now with the laws that we have? And what you bring up is really interesting because yeah, it's not that they want to prosecute or, you know, maybe they do, I don't know, but they want them to move along. And with any of those other things, they just couldn't really.
Well, that was their response, right? They said, we have to witness it. We can't, yes, of course we can do narcotics enforcement, but we have to witness it. Yes, of course, brandishing weapons illegal, but we have to witness it. Even if somebody else witnesses it, we can't act on that. And I think that if they were more direct in response to that, they would say like, well, now the probable cause is set by the tent itself. Mm-hmm. The tent itself is doing something wrong. And we're witnessing that, and thus we can take action on it, and that will be the big change going forward.
You know, one thing that I the more we've talked about this, that I think is really interesting is the camping ban to me, and it almost signifies that the mayor's office and Stephen Whitburn, they view not the fact that people are homeless as the crisis, they view the fact that it's so visible as the crisis. I mean, this ban itself feels more like a broom than it is, you know, an open door to a new house or an open door to a tent. And from that perspective, you see that this is all about managing visibility. Our reporter Will Huntsbury always talks about this ban is a street sweeping ban, mm-hmm. or a street sweeping ordinance, essentially. Which again, it's a move people along situation. It's not necessarily incarcerate them, although. Yeah, although that can happen, and even this safe campsite, for example, KUSI, the master of two faces, on every issue, you know, they post a picture of the safe camping site and with the caption "Outdoor Jail" or "Mayor Todd Gloria's Safe Sleeping Site." I think all of this has just gotten so toxic. I don't understand how we look back at any of the discussion of the past couple months and see that any of it was productive.
I think the mayor would take exception to what you said and would mm-hmm. say like, yes, I believe fervently in housing mm-hmm. and I pushed for housing and I want more housing, but there's just, it's all, there's a lot of things in the way of that. And we're trying real hard to get there and it's going to be a while. And in the meantime, I do think if you poured some like truth serum down him and he started talking, he would say like, however, what we've done is created a place that attracts people more than it makes them feel uncomfortable about being on the streets. And that we have to change, as he puts it, the expectation. And that the expectation for a long time has been that you can camp on the street mm-hmm. and that we are going to communicate very clearly that you can't mm-hmm. and that's over. And I think that's a really interesting step, but this is absolutely a sweeping thing. Now, what he will also say is that we have done a lot to increase our capacity and our support for homeless individuals and the places that they can go. In fact, when he was talking to the city council about the ban, this is what he said.
The unsafe camping ordinance is not a standalone solution. In fact, it comes after we have collectively worked together to expand shelter capacity by 70%.
So our Will Huntsbury took that as a fact check challenge, a classic voice fact check, and took it on and decided to look into that. Andrea, what did he find?
So it's all determined by where they start the clock for where they start counting. Basically, they start the count on a day in April 2021. Uh-huh. This is after the convention center closed, which they had opened during the pandemic to house homeless individuals. At that point, on that day that they begin the count, shelter capacity was at 1,071. beds.
In the city of San Diego, there were 1,071 beds for people who were homeless to use.
Yes.
And this was in April 2021.
And
where in Todd Gloria's, you know, reign as mayor does that April date fall?
That's 4 months after he came into office. Mm-hmm. So 4 months after he came into office, they start the count April 2021. There's 1,071 beds up to June 2023, when now we have 1,805 beds. So if you do the math there, yes, 70%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, our Will Huntsbury, he looked at January 2020 to compare to June 2023. In January 2020, we had 1,409 beds shelter capacity. When you compare those two numbers, it's 28%, not 70%.
Yeah, so January 2020. Now, let's put the April number into context. April 2021, when Todd Gloria starts his count and compares it to where we're at now with the 70% increase, that was a time when shelters were not allowed to have as many people because of the social distancing requirements imposed during the pandemic, right? And so comparing that artificially lowered time with the current time is, it's a little off. It'd be like, what did somebody say? It'd be like comparing.
Yeah, it would be saying that, you know, schools have increased in-person instruction by 1,000% since April of 2020.
Right. That there was so, there's obviously an artificially lowered situation at that point, and now there's no restrictions related to the pandemic, and so it's a lot higher. So yeah, the reason to go back to the time before that is like, what was his predecessor offering versus what he's offering? And 28% increase is not nothing. Right. It's not something to discount. Great job on that. That's nearly 30% increase in the number of spots available for people who are struggling, but it's not 70%.
And why do you think Todd or his staff or his comms folks, whoever cooked up this number, why do you think they felt the need to just get so tricky with these numbers? I mean, 30%, like you said, is not nothing at all.
I'm not sure if it's tricky as much as it's there. They have decided, again, they made a decision somehow in the last 6 months, I would say last 4 or 5 months, where they were going to stop treating this as something that they had to apologize for, like that they were done just being feeling bad about the situation, that they were done. You know, for instance, they used to take every measurement of how bad homelessness was as an attack, as a vulnerability that you were poking at. If you pointed out how bad homelessness downtown was or something, it was like it was seen as a personal sort of attack on the mayor. And I think what they decided to do over the last 4 or 5 months is change their approach and say, no, 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 no. We're going to meet this situation with something just as strong as it demands, that it's a crisis and we're going to meet it. And what they've chosen is this sort of punitive approach, this like, we are not going to welcome people anymore to sleep on the streets. We are going to set that expectation, as we said, higher, that they're not allowed to be there anymore, to send the message that we are going to be just as ferocious about not allowing this to develop as we are about the creation of opportunities and housing and shelter. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important for this to have both sides of it. When they presented the ban to city council, the big blowback they got was that they weren't matching the ban with adequate shelter. Uh-huh. And that was the hit that former mayor Kevin Faulkner hit them with, which was that like they weren't offering enough shelter. And so what they've decided to do is say, no, we are. We have done a lot of shelter. And so it's important for them to sort of, I guess, emphasize, if not exaggerate, what they've done on that side as much as possible. And so I think they want to be able to tell the community with a straight face that we're not just trying to sweep people. We're trying to shelter as well. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to deal with the fact that there aren't enough shelter spots. And so, you know, pointing out how fast they've gone to make up that difference is a key part of it. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. My my wife texted me the other day. She had just gone to the Home Depot at Sports Arena, and she had been asked if she wanted to fund pothole replacement and transit to the airport and all kinds of things. And she texted me and she said, "Is this real?" And I was like, "Well, I haven't heard about this. How is that real?" And turns out she'd scooped me, and they were circulating yet another effort to raise a half-cent sales tax countywide to fund part of Sandag's big transportation plan, including connecting to the airport, transit improvements, and some money, just a little bit, set aside for pothole replacement and street repair across the county. Mm-hmm. That, though, trust me, will be high up in how they pitch both the signatures and eventually the campaign. So remember, this is being sponsored by a coalition of labor unions. We've seen this before. It failed last year when they wanted to do the same thing, but they didn't collect enough signatures. They found out, even though they put millions of dollars into this effort, that they actually had come up short with signatures. Now, they claim that maybe they lost boxes at the registrar's office, or maybe they got miscounted or whatever, but regardless, it didn't get on the ballot. Mm. So here's another attempt to it. Now, it seems a little bit smaller, so I'm not sure how it'll have more success, but they say they've already turned in 15,000 signatures. They're doing great. They got a lot of support. The main support behind it is from IBEW, the electrical workers. Now, they don't have much interest in pothole replacement other than that they drive on them as well. But they're interested in building the transit, of course, and a few other things. The laborers are involved, Lee Una, and the carpenters are involved. And then a bevy of environmental and climate change groups are also supporting it.
So we always hear about half-cent sales tax, but that seems like such an abstract number. Is there an idea or a projection of how much this would raise a year?
Well, here's how I can answer that, Jake. So in 2004, they extended the half-cent sales tax that already existed. Mm-hmm. They projected it would bring in $14 billion, but our investigative reporting revealed that, in fact, it was only on track to bring in about $9 billion over the 40 years that it was in place.
Wow.
And so they use that money to leverage state and national sources. So if you ever hear like Biden passes the infrastructure bill, mm-hmm. and the bill has $30 billion for transit. And what usually happens is the federal government will go to a place like San Diego and say, like, do you have any projects? Mm-hmm. And if you have, you know, a third funded locally of that project and a third funded from the state, then the federal government will come in and put in that last third.
So they'll put like five on it.
Yeah. And then you can build that project. And that's sort of what happened with like the Midcoast Trolley and stuff like that. So I think that if the last one was projected to bring in $9 billion, this one probably projected to bring in like 12 or something. Mm. So that's how that works. And they want to be able to use it, of course, to leverage for other things. So that is interesting for a couple reasons. Now, one is, They tried in the past, of course, to get a half-cent sales tax increase through Sandag itself and approved by the voters. But in order to do that when it's Sandag itself, they have to get two-thirds of the voters to support it. Two-thirds of the voters to support anything is very difficult. There's already going to be a set block that opposes everything. And so getting two-thirds has always traditionally been very hard. I think they got like 54, 56%, right? So what happened, of course, since then is a court ruling that said that if it's a citizens' initiative not put on by the government itself, the citizens can make a law themselves if just a majority of citizens do that. And if the law says to raise taxes, then that law can go into effect with just a majority of voters. Mm. And so that's why there's been now two. This is the second effort to raise signatures, to put something on the ballot, to raise taxes for this sort of transit slash road slash get to the airport with a train plan and potholes in place. So,
and how realistic is it to ever have a train to the airport. I mean, is that really something that could happen with this new half-cent tax?
It is, because the airport itself was required to put aside so much money for that possibility, and the new terminal is being built with a way to do it easily. Okay. So it is possible. Uh-huh. Now, whether it's a good use of money, I think, is a fair question. Like, it's... It's one thing, like, if the airport was really far away from downtown and they needed a train to get to it, mm-hmm. to save all the car trips there, but it's not very far from downtown and there's already like nice convenient bus service to it.
Yeah.
That said, it is weird that the trolley goes right past the airport and still is not a nice, like, easy connection to it. Now, that is also interesting because the mayor of San Diego, Todd Gloria, along with City Councilman Raul Campillo, have been working behind the scenes on their own half-cent sales tax increase for the city of San Diego so that they can pay for all kinds of things that they want there, to pay mm-hmm. cops more, to fix roads more and parks more, to pay people more, and to serve the homeless situation more. They both aren't going to work good together, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to have, like, if you had like a property tax increase on the same thing as like a sales tax increase, but when you have two sales tax increases, which means you're basically voting to increase your sales tax by a full percentage point, that's not insignificant. That makes a difference to people's lives, especially the poorest people, because they usually spend more of their income mm-hmm. on things. And so that's not what they would like. And so I think it's really interesting that they're both sort of sticking to their guns. I talked to Gretchen Newsom, who's helping run this for the IBEW, the electricians union. And she's like, yeah, we're gung-ho. Our union members and everybody are seeing great response to this. Our polling shows that people want this. We're going forward with it, and nobody's asked us to not.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mayor's office is making clear that no, they still want to pursue this. Now, for the mayor's thing, the law is this: if you do a tax for a special thing like a stadium or something specific, it requires a 2/3 vote. But if you just put a tax on the ballot that says just give the government more money, then it's just a 50% plus one. Now, it seems kind of backwards.
It does seem counterintuitive, yeah.
Except for that's the point, right? They know that it's easier to pass a tax if you say specifically what it's for, and so they put that at a higher threshold. But if you just say, like, we just want to give the government of the city hall more money, then they put it at a lower percent. They're like, good try. Try for it. And so that'll be really interesting. Now, they'll probably try to get around it a little bit by passing a resolution on the side that says, if by chance we get more money, we'll use it for X, Y, and Z.
Hmm.
But
just as a tool for messaging about the
right
about the sales tax.
Now, at the same time, the Municipal Employees Association, the largest union of city employees, they combined with the Parks Foundation and the Libraries Foundation to put forward that ballot initiative to raise a parcel tax. Now, a parcel tax is different than a property tax. A property tax measures the value of a property and adds a tax on that per dollar of property you own.
Mm-hmm.
A parcel tax is just a flat fee per parcel that you own. And they want to do that flat fee to raise money for libraries and parks, and in particular things like Parks After Dark, these wonderful programs that are going on mm-hmm. around the community, but also to serve some of the parks, like actual infrastructure need.
Hmm.
That they collected and they thought enough signatures, but the Registrar of Voters said you didn't have. They are now suing the Registrar of Voters because they say a bunch of those signatures were thrown out for no good reason. Like, somebody just had a different capitalization of their home address versus mm-hmm. their official address, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to get that in place. So that could also go on the ballot. And at the same time, the Housing Federation is trying to support its own initiative that would go on the ballot that would add a transaction tax for every property worth more than $2.5 million when it sells. It would put a tax on that sale. So if you sold your home for $2.5 million, Jacob, your $2.5
million my $2.5 million home.
Yes. Yeah. Then it would add a tax to that, which could be, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that would go to fund affordable housing. Mm. And so they want that on the ballot as well. And so there's a lot of talk at City Hall and other places now about like which ones really are going to make it, which ones the mayor is going to support. Is he going to oppose this Sandag one because it messes with his plan for the city one, or is he going to try to support both, which adds a lot of complexity and potential problems? So
yeah, well, presumably the more tax measures you put on a ballot, kind of the more they drag each other down. Is that sort of the idea of the strategy?
That's the common sense. Now, yeah. I talked to Michael Zucchet, who runs he's the general manager of the Municipal Employees Association.
Uh-huh.
He says he doesn't see that in the data. He has no reason to believe that. But he does say if you have two things that are the same, like they're both sales tax increases, that's going to be a problem. And he'd like to see that avoided.
Huh. That makes sense.
Do you have a particular type of tax you like the most?
What?
I think
mansion transit, mansion transaction tax.
These?
Yes. Mansion tax, parcel tax, sales tax.
I think estate tax is pretty cool.
Estate taxes?
Yeah.
Like a wealth, like you're passing wealth along.
Like when you die, you got to give some back to the state.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool.
In terms of names, I think the mansion tax sounds cool.
Yeah.
That's a good name.
That is pretty cool too.
I think that's probably why they'll go with it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the estate tax.
They're not going to give you credit.
The estate tax could be viewed as the haunted mansion tax.
True.
Wow.
I'm so glad we're all in agreement about that.
Anyway, check out those. So we will keep track of which ones go forward and which ones don't, and the impacts and stakes involved, of course, if they do make the ballot. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in Greater Little Italy, the eastern edge of Greater Little Italy. In downtown San Diego, we're not actually close to Little Italy, except that we are in Greater Little Italy, and we are the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in that general vicinity. This is our last podcast of the fiscal year. Please help ensure Voice starts out next year strong and can sustain itself for the foreseeable future. We have a good and pure business model, but it depends on people like you who value it to push the button. So if you could do that now at vosd.org/podpeople. That's vosd.org/podpeople. You can become a member for as little as $3 a month with a bunch of great benefits, not the least of which is independent journalism thriving in your community. Join now at vosd.org/podpeople. That's vosd.org/podpeople. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez Villafana is our Managing Editor. Jacob McQuinney is our Education Reporter. Nate Joms, our Producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.